UFOs offer the best hope we have in understanding how to travel to another star system or another galaxy if we want to survive.
We're continuing with our Roswell show, 60 years of cover-up, and we have a very interesting person on the line from Sedona, Arizona, David Sarita, a noted producer and director. David, and researcher. I don't want to leave that out. How are you?
Good. How are you, Jerry?
Good. Now, you spent a little time hiking yesterday.
Yeah, Sedona is really a beautiful place. I mean, I'm from Los Angeles, and I'm actually thinking of moving out here for a year to get out of the big city. And it's also a very, good spot for sighting UFOs once in a while.
Now, we're going to get into the documentary. This is actually, I believe, four discs?
It's two discs. It's 4 1-hour.
Okay.
So it's like
okay.
A mini-series. It's like a UFO. It's kind of shot reality style and traditional documentary style. A UFO mini-series is what it is. And there's over 25 major personalities in the film. I mean, everything from decoding crop circles to young children having UFO sightings and experiences to, Professor Roger Weir, who talks about the connection from Pythagoras, the first great Greek mathematician, and some of the mass triangular UFO sightings we're having, and also invisibility. Pythagoras was really the first mathematician who believed that it was actually possible to see and experience invisible dimensions where he believed extraterrestrials or star beings communicated on that dimension. So in the film we go into invisibility, crop circles, decoded, which I believe is a giant quantum physics lesson on it on the chalkboard of the fields of these farmers. And we actually get into that. And then we go into Roswell and advanced propulsion concepts. We get a meeting at Lockheed Martin.
Yeah, I want to get into that Skunk Works meeting here in a minute. And a few things, you mentioned Roswell. We will be at the Civic Center with a big table, and we'll have your DVDs for sale there. We're also taping shows there during the week of the 60th anniversary. And we also will be down at the Cover-Up Cafe, which is just down the street from the UFO Museum. And we'll have copies of the DVDs there so people can buy them. And we also have a link to your website. And you got a great trailer there, by the way.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, from here to Andromeda.com.
Yeah, and we have a link to that. And we also are selling the DVD on our shopping site. So people can get this DVD. And as you say, it's 4 hours long. So you really cover some great subjects in great detail.
Well, you need a lot of time. Like I found, I did Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs kind of for mainstream last year, and it was all about getting into this, probably the most knowledgeable celebrity's mind on the subject of UFOs, and Aykroyd is a fascinating personality. But now I wanted to go much deeper than I had ever gone before. My first film was Evidence the Case for NASA UFOs, which now has 600,000 downloads on Google Video for people who don't want to watch it in good quality. And people seem to really, really like, Evidence the Case for NASA UFOs is a chalkboard. It's like being in a classroom and really going deep into UFOs and UFO invisibility and space shuttle footage and what the astronauts and their own scientists are saying about it. But in From Here to Andromeda, we start with where Al Gore leaves off. We start with global warming, the possibility of a mass extinction level event or a gradual mass extinction. And we interview a college professor at Santa Monica College, David Phillips, who tells us point blank that, we really don't have more than 10 years to reverse our ways, and he believes we need to elect a president who can literally transform our country in an emergency fashion to bring it to sustainability so we can, save the planet. And we start with that, but we realize that the likelihood of the whole world going from less than 1% sustainable, meaning non-polluting energy sources, to even 50% sustainable is not going to happen in the next 10 years. So the quest to find our way to another galaxy, to another star system begins. And I believe, once and for all, having actually seen a UFO myself when I was 7 years old in 1968 in Berkeley, California, that UFOs offer the best hope we have in finding out how to get to another star system. So we look at the UFO phenomena very deeply and into you know, the propulsion physics, how it's possible to obviate or circumvent the speed of light limit. And ultimately, we get, I believe, the interview of the century on UFOs at Lockheed Martin.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. When we talk about this whole event here, you I mentioned the Skunk Works. You actually talked to a person there, a scientist. I guess he's a senior scientist, would be his title, Boyd Bushman. And tell me a little bit about what all happened there. What can they see?
You know, the first question is, why does this individual, who's 20 years at Lockheed Martin, he designed the Stinger missile, which was called the Red Eye, back in the 60s and 70s when they were testing it. He designed all the infrared camera systems for aircraft. And, you know, he worked for Howard Hughes, Texas Instruments, the Shah of Iran. And 20 years at Lockheed Martin, the number one defense contractor in advanced aircraft concepts. So, and he was in the classified area, in the black ops area, and he doesn't believe, to answer the question is, why is this guy going public, he doesn't believe we're going to survive, you know, earth changes and global warming, and that these technologies, anti-gravity technologies, are our best hope at surviving, and he wants the world to have it. So he actually shows on camera, firstly, how UFOs work, how anti-gravity works, how he actually engineered it himself, his fascination with the UFO phenomenon, literally studies every case he can get his hands on, and then ultimately what happened at Roswell, and what he's saying is happening at Roswell is an iconoclasm for this particular UFO case. I mean, really, he just cracks it wide open, and what he says about it, nobody has ever heard this before. I mean, this is, you know, brand new news on Roswell. There's no question it happened, but what really happened is far more spectacular than anyone would have believed.
And you cover this in the DVD.
We cover this in the film. By the time you get to the fourth episode, I mean, we meet Boyd Bushman periodically throughout the film. We meet, you know, Professor Robert Thurman, who is a master professor on Far Eastern studies and Buddhism. And even for him, I mean, Time magazine called him one of the 25 most influential people of 1997 in the world. And for him to take on the subject of UFOs from the Tibetan Buddhist perspective was really incredible. He really opened up on it, and also getting into invisible cities. But when you see all these different professors throughout the film, and you see that, I mean, and you, I take people through kind of a case history, and actually relied a lot on the FBI's recently released, formally classified, 2,000 plus pages of UFO files, which are on their website right now. Just like Brazil and France released all their files, we released ours, but, you know, CNN is too afraid to cover the story. And what you find, before I tell people what Boyd Bushman is actually saying about Roswell, is this, in a post-World War II environment, you know, World War II ended with the advent of dropping the atomic bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki July and August of 1947. And right around that time, starting with Kenneth Arnold's sighting, in fact, Kenneth Arnold's original FBI memos are in these files, but they black out his name. Only if you know his story well, you know wherever they black it out that the name is actually Kenneth Arnold. But actually, going before Kenneth Arnold, there were sightings of UFOs all over our country at the end of the war, and we didn't know if it was the Japanese or if Hitler, you know, had actually reverse engineered anti-gravity technology, but there were saucers flying around over this country. And you look at these FBI files, and I have actually, you know, deeply gone over 400 or 500 pages so far out of the 2,000 plus pages I have. And I have them right in front of me right now. We were being invaded in 1947. We were chasing these things all over our country. We didn't know who they were. And we've got, you know, cases from the East Coast. You have the famous, you know, sighting up in Idaho by the United Airlines pilot right after Kenneth Arnold. Then you had the sightings at Portland, Oregon, which were reported in three of their newspapers on July 4th, 1947, just before the Roswell event. There's, you know, these UFOs are seen all over the Portland area, very similar to what Arnold saw. And we were chasing them in our little, you know, fighter jets, which, you know, were not even going, you know, beyond the speed of sound at that time. And the only thing that was breaking the sound barrier in the 40s was Glamorous Glennis, you know, Chuck Yeager and the X-1. So we weren't even going that fast. So we were seeing these things that were going, you know, according to Kenner Arnold, 1,800 miles an hour, you know, several, almost Mach 3, Mach 2 and a half, Mach 3. So we couldn't keep up to them, but they were all over the country. And some of the reports, according to the FBI memos, were 30-inch and even 16 or 12-inch test aluminum flying saucers that were American-made. There's one case I cite in From Here to Andromeda. This woman in North Hollywood has this aluminum saucer crash in her yard. The fire department comes. It's in North Hollywood. And the date is July 7th, 1947. You're talking about the same week as the Roswell incident, test saucers that we were building. And then when the FBI went into this particular case, a kid who worked at a gas station said he built it. Anti-gravity. And it, you know, caught on fire. It was a primitive experiment, but it worked. So where is this kid today, and where is anti-gravity research today, and why were kids building flying saucers that flew defying gravity in 1947 around the same time that we were being invaded for several years by alien flying saucers? So by the time you get to, okay, you have Poland in July 4th, 1947, then at Muroc Field, Edwards Air Force Base today, in these same FBI memos, there are over 8 military officers who signed affidavits that they saw UFOs hovering over Edwards Air Force Base. And this is, again, the same time, July the 7th, 1947. These are large saucers now, not the little one that crashed the same day in North Hollywood. And 9 military officers saying that they wanted to go up and chase them in their jets. I mean, I've got these reports right in front of me directly from the FBI's website. They're their files. So why? Why were there so many cases? And then when you get to Roswell, of course, we're in a post-World War II environment here. We want to find out, is this the Japanese? Is it, you know, is it Hitler's secret fleet of flying saucers? So Boyd Bushman charges that he knows personally a Navy doctor who's his friend today who treated a young pilot who just shot down the Roswell craft. And I said, with what kind of a weapon could you have shot down a flying saucer? Bullets are only 1,500 miles an hour in World War II. And Kenneth Hall said these things that he saw were doing 1,800 miles an hour or more. That's just when he saw them cruising. So there's no way these things would have any problem, you know, dodging bullets, moving that fast. And then you think, okay, when I said to Boyd Bushman, you know, you couldn't do it with a bullet, and he started laughing. He said, we have all kinds of things out there. Now, you have to remember that we developed the atomic bomb. You know, it was successful on July 5th, 1945, you know, in New Mexico, we tested the first atomic bomb. So nuclear electromagnetic pulse weapons would have been developed by then. But then when I started tracing down the weapons, I found something in the FBI memos that told me what the weapon was, most likely that shot down the Roswell craft. And I'm not going to tell you who it is. The scientist who developed it is one of the most famous scientists in history. But I'll tell you this. They were developing it in 1943 at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, when you know most likely that the most advanced weapon being developed at that time was developed at Wright-Patt, and we know that they took eventually the Roswell craft makes its way there. And it appears to these in these FBI memos that it stopped at Los Alamos National Lab. And it looks like, you know, Einstein and a lot of the greatest physicists of our time had access to it. And then it goes to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the very place where they're developing the weapon in 1943 that probably shot it down. Now, why was the pilot being treated? Because he had radiation burns. And according to Boyd Bushman, he launched out of Texas, and he was chasing this thing, and they were trying to make radio contact with it, again, post-World War II. We don't know it's aliens yet. And he said, you know, go. You have the weapon on board, the weapon. Go ahead and shoot it down. Those are Boyd Bushman's words from his friend, the Navy doctor, who treated the pilot. And the pilot proceeded to tell him the story. And then the pilot goes, lands his plane. He shoots this thing down. There's a big flash of light. We don't know the exact date of when they shot it down. And it crashes, and they go down into the hangar, the pilot, and they have 3 of the aliens in custody, but a 4th is out running around somewhere. And if I really get into that you know, that alien that's, you know, running at large in, you know, the great Southwest somewhere, and I think of Whitley Strieber when he talks in his books about how these aliens are transmorphic, meaning they could even possibly morph into a human being, and how this alien could be still living at large somewhere in our country. So here we have a man who's 20 years at Lockheed Martin. He has 26 U.S. patents on file, and if you look at his patents up on the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, all of them show up, and many of them say Lockheed Martin, Lockheed Martin, Lockheed Martin. And in fact, one of his patents is a very advanced way of detecting, you know, buried landmines.
Well, David, this weapon they used to shoot down the craft, was it some sort of ray?
Yeah, it's a ray. And you'll know when you see the film, I mean, everyone's going to know the name of the scientist, and it's actually a famous case.
Mm-hmm.
But I had no idea that the ray was, you know, being developed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I mean, everybody knows this scientist's name. I mean, he's a huge icon, and it will be no surprise when people see the end of the film. I just don't want to take away the surprise.
Sure, I understand.
But I found it in the FBI memos. I mean, one of my listeners in all the radio shows I do, actually, thanks to him, he tipped me off to these FBI memos. And, you know, Boyd Bushman wouldn't tell me the weapon. I wanted to know what was the weapon. And, you know, because it couldn't be bullets. I mean, I just can't buy that for the bullet theory. And, of course, when I track down the weapon, it just makes perfect sense that that's what it was.
Well, now your documentary, your film is From Here to Andromeda. These alien craft, the one that was shot down in Roswell, were they from Andromeda?
No, I don't think so. I can't verify where they're from. But the point of the movie about From Here to Andromeda is ultimately because NASA won't admit, or they really don't know if there's life anywhere in our galaxy at this point. In fact, that the new planet that they discovered that was the first possible true candidate for Earth-like organic life came at the end of the film. But the reason for From Here to Andromeda is because it's the ultimate challenge to be able to travel to your nearest galaxy 2.2 million light years away. And now Boyd Bushman, a brilliant physicist and engineer, not only shows us how anti-gravity works, he shows photographs that this classified nuclear-powered anti-gravity drive is being lowered into the belly of classified aircraft in the early 1950s at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base that we reverse-engineered, and he knows the scientists who were building it. He's the one who figured out how the anti-gravity works, ultimately. And they amplify this effect, which you'll learn about in the film. He shows small coil designs that produce anti-gravity, but then you amplify that. We end up finding out that the decoded message in cross circles was pointing to it all the time, all along. And that the way anti-gravity works is actually not that difficult to understand. And where they got it from, I believe, is by following the trail and having access to the Roswell craft and other crash cases. In fact, there's a case in front of me right now. This is August 1947. Captain Davidson and Lieutenant Brown, April, Army A2 Intelligence, Hamilton Field, California. That's up in the Bay Area near Mill Valley. They're talking about transporting debris from a flying disc fragment, another crash saucer incident. So one of the things that we also do with From Here to Andromeda is we get 8 of the top people in the ufology field, you know, people like Dr. Roger Weir and many other people in the room, Stephen Bassett, and we're debating because there appear to be so many crash saucer incidents. We're debating whether or not these ETs are not getting shot down by us necessarily. They might be shooting at each other in a kind of Star Wars incident over who gets Earth next after humanity, you know, possibly goes extinct. And so it's a very provocative argument. I mean, everybody has a different opinion and different reasons.
Yeah, speaking of provocative, I think in that film, you even mentioned that possibly the Columbia was shot down.
Well, it looks like we have a very strong case for the shuttle Columbia being shot down, and that is because of these photographs that were reported in the San Francisco Chronicle taken by an amateur astronomer, Peter Goldie, from England. And the photos were never released to the public by NASA, but on the internet some of the photos surfaced. The photographer reveals his secret identity by telling people he has the copyright and should take them off the internet, which is Peter Goldie, and he doesn't believe we have the right to see the photograph. So because I have had all five photographs and I have them in my possession, I'm not allowed to publish them, but they're so simple. I just make drawings in reference to what is going on in each photo in the film. And then, you know, we can clearly see this purple corkscrewing wave that is chasing the Columbia. And he takes five separate photographs, which are 4 to 6 seconds long, with his camera on a tripod. And NASA contends, without showing the public all five photographs, that it's a super lightning strike that is striking the shuttle. Well, lightning, and I show people this in the film, you know, lightning strikes in New Mexico, the longest lightning strike I have is a tenth of a second. That's the longest. Most are much shorter than that. So that means that a lightning strike from beginning to end could never show up in five separate photographs. It's that, you know, from beginning to end, this thing is chasing the shuttle. It's gaining on it. It course corrects at 90 degrees going past Mach 18. This, you know, the speed of the shuttle is Mach 18. And this thing is going way faster. It chases. It catches up to the shuttle. The moment it strikes the shuttle flares up in brightness. And moments later, in time, we lose contact with all the astronauts. So what happens next is Dr. Roger Weir, who's one of the chief ufologists in our UFO debate, says he attends a meeting in Toronto, Canada, where there is clear evidence in examining the debris of the space shuttle that it was struck by some kind of plasma weapon. Well then, you know, I never even knew this was going to happen, but months later, I get an interview with this guy, George Mosman, who's an investment banker in Hollywood, and he said he was in Dallas the day the shuttle went down with his attorney, and that they were looking through the Zeiss binoculars to see, you know, what was going up in the sky, and way over to the side were two metallic flying saucers. One was maroon-colored in his description, very clearly seeing them through the Zeiss binoculars. They were definitely flying saucers or metallic, you know, discs. And in the photographs of Peter Goldie, the thing that's chasing the shuttle is maroon colored. It's violet purple kind of color. So I deduct in the end that most likely this thing was chasing the shuttle and somehow shot it down. And that is really, really difficult for the American public to look at.
Yeah, now I wonder, do you think it was, tracking the why would they shoot the shuttle down? I mean, that's what I'm getting.
Because if we shot them down at Roswell, and it appears that we continue to shoot some of these things down when you look at.
So you think there's a little a confrontation going on?
Think of what Reagan said in the United Nations, and I put that in the film. It's a classic statement. He said, if we were all facing an alien threat, how quickly our differences would dissolve, and we would all come together to face the common threat. And why Star Wars? Why all the, you know, weaponization of space? So if ETs, if there's something going on that is beyond the boundaries of what we know about, you know, how we're relating and communicating with extraterrestrials, there might be something that they were doing on that mission. Perhaps there was a classified payload on the space shuttle. And I know most of the space shuttles that we launch have classified payloads from Department of Defense. Maybe we were weaponizing space. Maybe we were doing something we weren't supposed to. I don't know, but it just looks so clear to me that that is not a lightning strike. A lightning strike cannot survive five separate exposures of 5 to 6 seconds each, including the time delay in between exposures. Not the same lightning strike. It can't keep showing up on the same camera. I mean, there's just no way. Lightning doesn't behave like that. So, and it's clear this thing, a lightning strike would reach its target nearly instantly. And this thing is going much slower than that. I mean, it's faster than the shuttle, but it's gaining on it. Each frame, each photograph, it gets closer to the shuttle and closer. Course corrects at 90 degrees, chases it, and then strikes it. I mean, it's the evidence is really clear that something struck the shuttle.
And now, when we talk about these things, you go into great depth in the film, and you got 4 hours, so you deal, and there's no way we can cover all that on this radio show.
No.
But it appears that, you know, there may be not all goodness and sweetness to the ET phenomenon. There may be some people out there trying to do us harm, and there maybe we're the ones doing it.
Well, if you really think about it, it was bad timing for ETs to be coming into America right after, you know, World War II. I mean, we didn't know who they were, and we did have some pretty advanced nuclear weapons at that time. So, of course, we're going to be firing at enemies that don't communicate. Now, if they communicated with us in a friendly manner and said, okay, we're from another star system, then maybe we would have, you know...
But there's no evidence they did that.
There's no... According to Boyd Bushman, there's just no contact at all. I mean, there's... Maybe they don't even use radio waves.
But you would think that, like you say, they were probably aware of our situation right after a world war. I mean, there seems to me some good evidence about UFOs and nuclear weapons anyway. They don't seem to like them.
Well, if you look at all these FBI memos, the UFO sightings continue after Roswell all the way through August of 47 into September. In fact, most of the pages of the 2,000 pages, the 1947 date is there. You know, just, you know, in the months preceding Roswell and after. So they were still hereafter. And they were flying around, possibly even looking for their alien friends. I don't know. But there's no doubt, in my opinion, when you look at these reports. Now, there are a few reports that look like they're balloons or people are misguided in their interpretation. But there's a lot of evidence here that there were large metallic craft going many thousands of miles an hour in our own country. But what's most peculiar is teenagers building models that are anti-gravitic. And how did they get the information? Was it psychically transmitted in a dream state? Was it spontaneous awakening in their mind that was, you know, that the extraterrestrials were teaching them? But it's really bizarre. You see these 17-inch little models, and when they take them apart, the FBI takes photographs of them, and they say, made in the USA, there's various parts inside. There's, you know, radio tubes, Tesla coils, and aluminum is key. Boyd Bushman shows us there are certain metals, when they're strobed with the specific types of wave functions that produce anti-gravity, that open up this higher force that reveals the anti-gravity force. So you're going to learn a lot about how we're going to get to Andromeda. And ultimately, he tells us, I ask him point blank, you know, Ben Rich, the former head of Lockheed Skunk Works, is reported to have said that we already have the technology to go to the stars and beyond. He passed away. And he said that at a UCLA alumni speech. And now we have Boyd Bushman, another scientist, senior scientist, 20 years at Lockheed, saying the same thing. Ultimately, he tells us they're way past anti-gravity now. He said of the four or five known forces, atomic forces we know of, the strong force, the weak force, gravity, and electromagnetism, he said they've already identified forces number 6, 7, 8, and 9.
Wow.
And those forces, I asked them, could we get to the Andromeda Galaxy on those forces? And you'll have to see what he says. They're not theoretical forces on paper like string theory is. They've actually done this.
Yeah, I understand. We're going to have to talk again maybe next month after Roswell.
Yeah, let's talk after Roswell and see what happens. And another thing, just so people know, I interviewed Jesse Marcel Jr., the third.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that.
Briefly, I'll say that the reason I'm interested in Denise Marcel, John Marcel, and Jesse the Third is because I'm interested in how this legacy, how this story will survive when their father, Jesse Marcel Jr., passes away. How are Roswell's grandchildren going to continue the legacy? Because Jesse Marcel Jr. is the son of Captain Jesse Marcel, the first witness at Roswell. So how is this story going to survive? So for those of you who want to know why I chose him, it's because that's because of that reason.
Okay, it's From Here to Andromeda, and it's available on the website. It's available. You have a website as well. And we'll be at our table at the Civic Center and also down at the Cover Up Cafe all week of the Roswell anniversary. 60 years, that's hard to believe.
It's amazing, 60 years. And now, it's really amazing that Boyd Bushman comes out with this information in perfect timing for the 60th anniversary.
Well, and Walter Hout's affidavit just came out, too. So there's all kinds of things happening here. Who knows, by the next time we talk, David, what will have happened.
Yeah.
And so we'll talk to you in about a month or so.
Okay.
And, hey, if you get a chance, Sedona's not that far away. Come on down to Roswell.
Well, if I could find a hotel down there now, I mean, it's kind of last minute for me. I'm going to be in Santa Fe on July 3rd and 4th, so it's another, 5 hours from Santa Fe?
Right. If we run across a hotel, they're rare to find, but if we do, we'll call you. We got your cell number.
Call me on my cell and let me know.
I will. Look forward to working with you again. Thanks very much, David.
Be in touch, Jerry.
Okay, bye.